This is a podcast for Monday, November 7th, 2011. Ethics. So today we're going to start on deontology. Just a reminder, because I didn't give you a heads up on the exam that opened last Wednesday, it's currently open. I'm giving you until Monday to take it. So you have a whole week plus last week. I think I just had one person take it. So you have till next Monday, close of labs, to take the second midterm exam. It only covers chapters 5 and 6. It only covers...
Yes.
Yeah, 5 and 6. So I'm going to make sure I didn't make a mistake. Chapters 5 and 6, egoism and social contract theory, and utilitarianism. And the reason for that is utilitarianism is a big chapter, and it's got a lot of a lot of information. There's a lot to utilitarianism. It's one of the main moral theories. We spent a lot of time talking about egoism in class, too, so this is the way things sort of break up. And so then the final will cover everything we're going to do today until the last day of class, which is deontology, which is the view of Immanuel Kant. The other sort of big gorilla in ethics, besides utilitarianism, Aristotle, who sort of had a resurgence of interest lately in his theory. About in the 70s, people started getting interested in virtue ethics again. It's sort of been seen as passé for a while, and now it's enjoyed a kind of a revived reputation as a kind of major contender, but still not as big as deontology and utilitarianism. So I'm like reviewing an ethics book, for example, for an intro class, and they're talking about a utilitarian versus a Kantian approach, and they don't talk about any other ethical theories. So that's, that's, if you're going to pick two to talk about in an intro class, these are usually the two. And if you think about your day-to-day decisions, they tend to be the way people think, either in terms of rights and responsibilities, what's fair, what's just, equality, treating people with dignity and respect, versus thinking about how can I create the best outcome, how can I create the greatest good for the greatest number, which is a more utilitarian idea. So now we're going to get to the Kantian idea, which says that consequences don't matter at all, and that ethics is all about thinking about abstract moral principles and applying them to particular situations, consequences be damned. So let me just get my PowerPoint here, and we'll get started. I'll have the PowerPoint posted right after class. Brief announcement. There will be a debate hosted by Students for Liberty, and it will be hosted in the cafeteria tomorrow in the South Side, where there used to be that big screen TV where they have all the vending machines and like tables and stuff. I'm trying to think of what. Over by the vending machines and the restrooms. actually, there's two sets of restrooms. So over by the vending machines in the far corner, that's actually closest to this classroom here. So it's called the South Side of the Cafeteria. And there'll be a debate on the cost of higher education. Why does college cost so much, and what can we do about it? And so we've got two debaters. One is coming up from Roseburg. Another one, I think, is part of like the Student Democrat Club. So one will give a more kind of free market approach, the other one will give a more state-sponsored education approach, and different diagnoses about what the problem is and different solutions. And so that will be 11:30 to 1 o'clock. You don't have to, if you want to come and just listen to part of it, that's fine. You don't have to stay for the whole thing. If you like, I have that extra credit paper assignment. If none of those topics appeal to you, you can write on the debate. And the only thing I'd say is that if you write on the rising cost of higher education, you should approach it from the standpoint of the ethical theories we've been discussing. So say you might say, identify what parts of the arguments of each speaker were utilitarian-type arguments versus deontology-type or Kantian-type arguments. And if you have any questions about how you do that, you can see me, but you could use that as a paper topic if you like. So again, that's tomorrow, South Side of the Cafeteria, 11:30 to 1 o'clock. And both the presenters are students. We thought it would be good to restrict the topic to students, so it's not like some educator, whatever that happens to mean. Usually it's like some bureaucrat who has never taught in a classroom in their life. You see people, they have these doctorates in education, and their teaching experience is limited to telling other people how to teach, even though they've never taught in a classroom in their life, other than like a sort of like seminar with other budding young teachers, filling their heads full of nonsense usually. Anyway, so it's not like, you know, supposed experts, but these are students who have, you know, done the research and I think have some good arguments and offer unique perspectives on education, but they're one of you guys. And so they know, they've experienced, you know, that the problem with education has been going up 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation every year. And when I was first came here to Lane, it was about $35 a credit hour. So now is it 82 or something, 83? 84. So it's getting tough out there. And when I was in California, it used to be there was no tuition for the community college. It was free. You just had to pay for your books. And that's gone up hugely, too. And we talked last time, or not last time, but last, I don't know, a few class sessions ago about how the true cost of education isn't just what you guys are paying, but it's like the total budget of the budgets of every college has been going up, up, and up. And so the question is, why does it cost so much? What, you got a classroom, you got to turn on the lights, maybe if you want some fancy technology, it costs you a little bit of money. But, you know, when you look at the amounts of money that goes, you know, where does it go? And I hope that one of the issues will be raised is, you know, a heavily unionized, professionalized workforce where people are getting pension funds, which are bankrupting the state. Not so much us. I think the K through 12 is really where most of the financial pain is. But we have our share too in the university system. And this will be focused on higher ed, so they won't be talking about K through 12 at all. Okay, so let me get this up here. Oops, I put that in the wrong place. Anybody have any remaining questions about the study guide or about egoism, social contract theory, or utilitarianism? I didn't talk about rule utilitarianism in class here. Rule utilitarianism, briefly, is this it's kind of like soft universalism. It's a way to try to straddle the fence between two views. So rule utilitarianism says, instead of trying to figure out which act will maximize happiness, try to figure out which rule that, if everyone followed it, would maximize happiness. So instead of like looking, you know, sort of at individual acts, you look at what principle, if universally followed, would maximize happiness. And so it seems to solve some of the problems where you say, well, what if everyone, when they could, save the hospital money, bumped off one of the patients, right? Well, what if every doctor did that? Then you'd have, you know, patients dying left and right. What if everyone was killed when it was a, you know, financial inconvenience? Well, that would lead to really bad consequences. And so the idea is, instead of looking at the particular act, you look at what the best, what the rules would be, which would create the greatest good for the greatest number. And I think that the thinking behind this is, if you have these rules that can't be broken, they're kind of like these deontological absolute principles, but they're focused not on, you know, amorphous things like dignity or respect or rationality, whatever that is, right? But it's focused on the consequences. So you think, what would produce the best consequences? Not what act will produce the best consequences, but what rule, if universally followed or if everyone followed it, would lead to the best consequences, the greatest happiness. And,
it's a little off topic, but I had a question about, you said that utilitarianism and...
Okay, can you hold that, your question for just a moment? I just want to finish this point about real utilitarianism, and then I'll get to you. So the problem with that is it seems to collapse into act utilitarianism. So you ask yourself, what rule, if universally followed, would create the greatest happiness? Well, it seems like Suppose you have a rule like, okay, don't kill, right? That's your rule, and you think, okay, no killing is the rule that if everyone followed it would maximize happiness. And you think, well, but what about like self-defense? Okay, well, let's make an exception. So we'll say our rule is going to be don't kill unless in self-defense. But then what about like a just war? Suppose it's, you know, World War II and Hitler and Tojo are trying to take over the world. Okay, well, if it really is a just war and not just some, the imperialist aggression or something, right? If it really is a just war with a just cause, then maybe that's okay. So killing in self-defense and in war. And then what about, you might say, what about some person who's like committed like mass, multiple homicides or something? Okay, make an exception for capital punishment, right? And then so you sort of go down the line and you think, well, what am I doing in each of these cases? Why did I make an exception for self-defense and war and maybe capital punishment? It's like, well, because I'm thinking that in these cases it wouldn't maximize happiness if I follow this rule. So it seems like it all boils down to just follow the rule of maximizing happiness with every act, right? So it goes back to don't kill unless it maximizes happiness. But that's kind of a long-winded way of saying maximize happiness. So you're back to act utilitarianism. So that the way that's expressed is rule utilitarianism collapse into act utilitarianism. Because when you start thinking about what rule would create the greatest happiness, it's, well, the rule of go out and try to create the greatest happiness, right? Because all these other rules are going to run into some circumstances in particular cases where they're not going to work out so well. So it's kind of a way of trying to have your cake and eat it too. Okay. Now your question.
So you said deontology and utilitarianism are the biggest players in a technical discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't some of the other ones like individualism or mind command or egoism big contenders in a technical debate?
That's a really good question. Why is that? Let's see. There's some historical reasons. In large part, and there's a couple of things going on. Egoism isn't big, for one thing, because of the heavy influence of altruism in society, in particular like the sort of religious versions. And so Ayn Rand once referred to altruism as the vampire which haunts Western culture. And so she says, you have the Renaissance where people started developing science and reason became the way you do things. And people got sort of more secular, and maybe if they believed in God, it was sort of an abstraction. They didn't believe in miracles and demons and ghosts and goblins and all this stuff, which she saw as sort of the vestiges of superstition. And so people got more rational, but still in the back of their mind they're thinking, well, okay, even if there is a God or even if there isn't, it still makes sense to love my neighbor as myself. And I still believe that that I still have this sort of ethic of charity and that I should spend a lot of my time and effort sacrificing myself to help other people. And she sees that as sort of a vestige of Christianity that's left over, that still even an atheist is still thinking, well, I should be a good guy. Why? Because it's my duty. And I should help people because I should. And they don't make this connection between the sort of Judeo-Christian heritage. They're going on based on rules that according to Rand, no longer make sense and didn't make sense in the first place, I guess. And Nietzsche will make this point too when we get to him. He talks about this idea that God is dead, but people don't realize it yet. So I think that's what Rand might say. There's all sorts of reasons why, like, human beings are social animals, and it's really hard to be an individual. So I think that's another reason why egoism sort of is not popular. That's why, libertarians get 1% of the vote, right? Because most people, they want to be taken care of. They say they want freedom, but they don't want the responsibility that goes with it. And those might be two big reasons. The other big reason would be, like, public education is sort of there's kind of a, I don't know if it's an orchestrated plan, but the sorts of people who become teachers are people that tend to have a kind of a idea of, you know, teaching is one of those helping professions, like being a nurse. And so people that go into teaching tend to be more altruistic in their outlook. And so that those values, and then you have a highly unionized workforce in public education. And so those values tend to filter into early influences in children. And so they tend to think about themselves as being sort of part of a social machine, or as being part of a group rather than being individuals. So I know there's probably stuff in academia where, you know, Kant and Mill sort of took over a big place in the canon and are regarded as being it. And they sort of, you know, you get a bit of academic conservatism that enters into. So probably a lot more I could say about you should move on. But it's an interesting question. Okay. The ontology. Kant, Immanuel Kant's founder of deontology. You don't see people smiling in general in these pictures that they paint of people. It was sort of not considered to be dignified. Maybe sometimes you'll get a picture of a woman later on and when they're doing portraiture who might have like a thin little smile like the Mona Lisa. Or, but you know, Kant, I get the feeling Kant didn't smile very much at all. He's kind of a dour individual. Kant is a typical kind of stoic Germanic. He's all about duty. And to Kant, morality is all about your duties and responsibilities. And if you can enjoy yourself a little bit, you know, every once in a while, I guess it's okay. But he's really focused on duty. And in Kant's mind, you know, deontology is all about, it's all about rights and responsibilities, doing your moral duty. And duty and self-interest are seen, or morality and self-interest are seen as being in going off, taking opposite ways. And so, to the extent that you do what you want to do, you're shirking your moral duty, and vice versa. So he's a founder of what's known as deontology. Deon is just the Greek word for rule. So if you can think of it literally, it's the rule theory. And the rule theory says there are these absolute, universal moral principles derived from pure reason, which will tell you what to do in any given situation. And they're true, again, universally, so this is a form of absolutism or universalism. They're true whether you believe in them or not. Kant thinks they're self-evident. If you just sort of reflect on them and think through logically what you should do, you'll come up with the right answer. So definition of deontology, the right act is that which is in accordance with the correct moral rule, you know, or principle, if you like. Again, moral rule, deon. You could go out a little more, I suppose, and say, you know, that these rules describe your rights and responsibilities, and that they're absolute. So it's a form of absolutism, and it says, for every act, there's going to be a correct moral rule or principle which will tell you what to do. And again, these rules have nothing to do with the consequences. They're derived, Kant says, from pure reason, from pure logic. They have nothing to do with desire. They're known through rational intuition. So the right act is that which is in accordance with the correct moral rule, deon, Greek deon, or principle. And Kant calls these maxims. So in the reading, he talks about, you know, if my maxim is blah, blah, blah. He's just talking about a particular form of a moral rule or principle. Like, don't take property which doesn't belong to you, say. Would be an example of a maxim. Or one of his examples is, When I'm in need of money, I'll lie to a friend in order to borrow some with no intention of paying it back. That might be an example of a maxim. So Kant completely rejects hedonism. So remember, utilitarianism says that hedonism is the correct theory of value, that the only thing of intrinsic value is happiness or pleasure. And they treat happiness and pleasure as being the same thing. Pleasure, happiness is what you have when you have a life of pleasure and not very much pain. And so you see a stark contrast with utilitarianism. Oops. He also rejects consequentialism. So remember, in utilitarianism, and this will be on the test, utilitarianism says that the consequences are the only thing that matters when trying to figure out whether something's right or wrong. That they're the only thing of moral relevance. So if I'm trying to figure out what should I do in this situation, the only thing you should look at is what are the consequences, and in particular, how much pleasure are you producing, how much pain are you producing, not just for yourself, but for everybody involved. So if you're you're in a monogamous relationship and you had sex with another woman, and you're wondering, well, should I tell my wife? You're not thinking in terms of, does my wife deserve to be told, right? That's more of a Kantian approach, because there's no sort of, does she have a right to know? No, you don't want to think about that. If you're a utilitarian, you're thinking, what effect would it have on my wife if I told her? And if you think, she'd forgive me, it'd be a little bit of pain, but she'd thank me for even though I did something wrong, she'd be glad that I told her, and she would be very grateful, and in the long run it might be better for our relationship, then you should do it. If you think she would maybe she has a jealous streak, and she's sort of paranoid, and she's insecure, and she might have an absolute rule, and maybe one she might have told you years ago, if you ever step out on me, by God, I'm going to leave, and there's nothing you really could do to change my mind. So don't you ever, right? And if you value the relationship, you're like, well, I'm not going to, ruin this, right? And suppose you might even think, well, I'm not just thinking of myself, but what if you think that your wife, benefits greatly from the relationship, whether it's, financially or emotionally? Maybe you're a really good husband, and this is just some little dalliance, and it was a moment of weakness, and because you feel so guilty about it, you're never going to do it again. So then you would say, okay, given all these consequences as a utilitarian, I'm not going to tell my wife. Kant, I think, would say that's not the way you figure out what to do, what the right thing to do is. What you have to figure out is what your wife's right, whether your wife has a right to know, and whether it's your responsibility to tell her. So it's all about, and whether it's things like dignity and honor and respect, and whether you're treating your wife, as an end in herself and not just as a means to you having a good life and so on. So Kant would say that you sort of have to consider the moral principles regardless of the consequences. So it could be, in Kant's view, that if you do the right thing, it could lead to both of you being completely miserable. And that's the possible outcome. It's different from rule utilitarianism, which I just described. The rules of deontology are not based on the consequences. They're not based on how much happiness they would produce. And Kant's really strong on this point, that the rules come from reason. They come from rationally considering the nature of the act that you're about to perform or thinking of perform, the principle it represents. And again, whether you're treating a person with free will, as a person with their own interests and desires, or whether you're just treating a person as a sort of a tool for you getting what you want, or whether you're doing what you ought to do based on your who you are as a person, as a free rational agent, and whether you're respecting others as free rational agents. And we'll see how this works in concrete terms in a minute. But again, nothing to do with consequences. And so rule utilitarianism has rules, but the rules come from someplace else. The rules in utilitarianism is here are the best rules to create the greatest happiness. conscious, if you follow the correct moral rule, you might create a lot of unhappiness, but it still might be the right thing to do. For example, if you torture a terrorist to avert if you refrain from torturing a terrorist and it leads to a nuclear bomb going off in a major U.S. city, you're going to create a lot more unhappiness, right? But Kant would still say it's always wrong to torture. Even if it leads to 10 million people being incinerated, it's still wrong to torture a person, even if that person is guilty of something. Because you can't, and so Kant has this kind of absolutist view about certain things you just can't do. Remember, utilitarianism says that the only thing which is intrinsically good is pleasure or happiness. Kant says it's a goodwill. So he says, if you think about what is valuable in and of itself, and he says the only thing which is always good is having a goodwill. And what does this mean? First, it means acting independently of the consequences. So when you're acting with a goodwill, you're not paying attention to what's going to cause what. You're acting with regard to absolute moral principles. Oops. Something's not showing up here. So a goodwill acts independently of the consequences. I think I had another bullet point that something's acting up for weird here. I'll just go on here. Goodwill acts independent of the consequences. That's not supposed to be there. Okay, so he considers some other intrinsic goods. So a goodwill acts independent of the consequences. It's the only thing which is good without qualification or intrinsically. And so what other people say is good? So happiness. Can you think of a case where happiness might be bad? Any ideas? Where would be a case where somebody's happy and it's like a bad thing? Yeah.
Ted Bundy was pretty happy.
Yeah, so someone is happy at like killing, some like serial killer that gets her dollies out from the other people's sufferings. What about another example? Bad happiness.
Gambling.
That seems somewhat controversial.
If you got a stroke, if you have a streak of bad luck, but you're still having fun.
Well, it depends. Like, it depends on what your attitude about winning and losing, I guess, is. It seems like if you have a gambling addiction, then you're going to be really unhappy, or you probably lose a lot of money. I'm not sure, like, if gamblers who lose are still happier than if they hadn't gambled before. I would guess no. Like, is William Bennett really, you know, did he really enjoy gambling so much that even when he lost, he said, yeah, it was still worth it? Plus all the scandal that came out. He had this book called the Book of Virtues, and people were referring it to as the Bookie of Virtues. he's a talk show host, and he was education secretary, actually, going back to education, and a high roller, and this sort of Christian conservative kind of who said a lot of moralistic things, and it turns out he's got this sort of gambling problem. So I would say that that was bad for him. Why do you think gambling is? Why would you say gambling is bad? I'm just kind of interested in.
I've known some people that they keep gambling, you know, keep playing, and they have fun and keep playing the game, even though they lose a lot of money over it in the long run.
Okay, yeah. So maybe they're harming their long-term good, but maybe they're. So I suppose that's the case. You might say things like maybe smoking cigarettes. People get a lot of pleasure from it, but then you might. What's the long-term? So I mean, go either way on this. I think that you might say that long term, not having the money is going to make them more unhappy. And maybe if it doesn't make them more unhappy than they gambled, then maybe it's okay. But if you think about again, the greatest good for the greatest number, probably like gambling that fills the coffers of the casinos, but maybe that money would be better given to homeless people or something, or helping third world famine relief. So, I was wondering about William Bennett with the millions he spent, you know. He gives a lot of money to World Vision and Stump for them, too, but, you know, instead of giving $1 million to them, what if he gave $2 million to them? Anyway, I'm thinking, Let's just keep on going on. So happiness, you know, a tyrant, like Saddam Hussein used to do things like, he'd like take like prisoners and he'd like torture them and video record and then like watch the videos while he knocked back hard liquor with his, you know, expensive scotch with his mistress. One thing he did, he took a guy and dressed him up in a Superman costume and then took him up to a high building and threw him off to see if he could fly. And he was like watching the video of this and yucking it up. Right, so he's getting a lot of happiness from that, and maybe like if he gets enough henchmen in front of the tube, maybe you have 10 happy people and one unhappy person, maybe that you get more happiness. So Kant says evil people don't deserve to be happy. Bad people, or when you do something bad, you don't deserve happiness from that. So you can't say happiness is intrinsically good. Intelligence, can intelligence be bad? Can you be too smart? Too smart for young good. Yeah, so he used his smarts for evil purposes, right? So you have the evil genius or a person who uses their intelligence to swindle people, to cause a lot of unhappiness, or even just if you don't cause unhappiness, just to do things that are wrong. So even though intelligence is good when coupled with what? A goodwill, right? If you use your intelligence for good purposes to, you know, create products and inventions that people could use to develop a skill or talent that's of benefit to others, and that's fine. But if you use it to evil purpose, then it's bad. How about wit? What can be wrong with, like, you know, making people laugh?
You might insult, like a really sarcastic comedian.
Yeah, you might make somebody feel bad. You have like a friend of mine. He was in junior high, and there was this guy in his class that had really bad skin. So he made up a limerick about it, and it was this guy. It was the guy's name was Russ. So it was Russ pimple pus pops his zits all over Russ. Right? And, you know, when you're in junior high and you're a boy, that's, like, hilarious, right? So every time Russ would come by, his friends would get, you know, they'd all, like five or six of them would go, Russ, pimple pus, pops his zits all over Russ. And they'd laugh, you know, and my friend had a good time with it. And he's, like, telling me, you know, years later, I feel so guilty about that because that guy's life, we made that guy's life miserable. They even, like, they would be in class and they would, like, tap out the rhythm with their pencils, you know. And everybody knew what it was, so it's like they didn't even have to say the words. And so that's a case where you have people, like, you know, having a good time at somebody else's expense. And so Kant would say that kind of thing is just cruel wit or sarcastic wit, when you're harming other people or maybe spreading racial stereotypes or and so on, is bad. Or even if, you know, you're spreading, like, you know, morally wrong views or something like that. Like, when someone is, you know, making a persuasive presentation, if they have a joke, it tends to sort of woo the crowd. And so, yeah, I won't mention anybody in particular, but you think about, like, somebody in the media who people love because they're funny, but maybe they're spreading really, like, subversive and ideas which are really bad for society, and people don't know any better, but they agree with the ideas because they think it's funny. Or you have, like, satire, like political satire, for example, is one form of spreading ideas, which is kind of subversive and subtle, in that people yuck it up at the jokes, and then they buy the ideas without thinking about them critically because they're too busy laughing. Freedom. Can freedom be bad? How can freedom be bad? You think of a case where you'd say, oh, people are too free, or so, it's bad that a person had the freedom to do X.
How about freedom that gives you the choice not to do your duty?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think Kant would say, like, you're by nature you're a free person. if a person uses their freedom in a bad way, that's still bad. Now, Kant doesn't want to restrict your freedom to do certain things, except for, I guess, you know, directly harm other people. But I think Kant would say that if you can misuse your freedom. So it's not like he wants like the government controlling you or something. But he would say that you're a free individual, but you can misuse your freedom. So you know, liberty isn't license. So he would say like you might use. I'm thinking like this guy Fred Phelps that protests at military funerals. So you might say he has a right to freedom of speech, but what he's doing is really wrong because he's, you know, making the families of dead, you know, soldiers feel awful, more awful than they already do, for no good reason, or at least for reasons that aren't strong enough to make it something that would be legitimate. Now I'm sort of lapse into utilitarian thinking, maybe. Anyway, so all of the above, you know, these can be bad if they're not combined with goodwill. So what's the only thing that's good here is a goodwill. If you have a goodwill, then all the other goods, when coupled with goodwill, will be good. But none of them in themselves can be good because when coupled with malevolent intent, they're going to be bad. So Kant says the only thing good without qualification, or I think we can roughly translate that into intrinsically good, is having a good will. You know, acting with, you know, it's like the wise men, right? We have Christmas is coming up. And there's that phrase, peace on earth, goodwill towards men. It's like, you know, being benevolent, having a good will towards other people. For Kant, it's goodwill means acting with the proper motive. So, for Kant, motive is everything. That's when you look at whether you did is right or wrong. You have to look at why did you do that? What reasons did you have? Again, contrast this with Mill, the utilitarian. Mill says motive is irrelevant to whether your act was right or wrong. It might show that you're a good or a bad person, but as far as whether what you did was right or wrong, according to Mill, doesn't matter. So Kant says motive is everything. The reason why you did what you did, it is going to determine whether the act is right and wrong. Now you think, well, what if I do the right thing for the wrong reason? Well, we'll come to that later on. Or what if I did the wrong thing for the right reason? And so Kant's got an answer for that, but he says that when you're looking at what moral principle you're following, generally you have two types of motives. You have desire and reason. Desire, he thinks, is selfish. And so Kant thinks about desire the way a psychological egoist would. He thinks all desire is selfish. So to the extent that you're thinking about wants and needs and what you would like to do, you're thinking about yourself. To the extent that you're using reason, you're thinking about others. You're thinking about abstract moral principles. You're thinking about what your duty is. And so desire comes from the flesh. It comes from your bodily desires for food and sex and comfort. And then reason deals with abstract principles. So boiling this down, he talks about a shopkeeper. He says, suppose you have a shopkeeper and he's scrupulously honest. He never cheats a customer. What might be his motive? Well, Kant says, if you're like a small business owner, maybe you're running like a little convenience store, it might be that you're just a naturally nice person, and you don't even think about cheating your customers. You know, Mrs. Jones comes in her motorized scooter, and she's got the glaucoma, doesn't see too well, always bumping into your displays, and she grabs that pack of Frieden and puts it on the counter, and then hands you a bill in her, you know, shaking little hand, and drops it on there, and it's like a 50, right? It'll be oh so easy to just take that 50 and pocket it and give her change for a one. But you don't even think about doing it. You're like, oh, your automatic reaction is, oh, Mrs. Jones, you gave me a 50 here, let me help you, and you give her the correct change. And you don't even think about cheating her. It doesn't even enter into your mind because of the way you were raised or because you're just sort of, you have some sort of kind and honest disposition, might be part of your genetic makeup. That's just the kind of person you are. Kant says, if that's why you did it, you get no moral credit. You're not even thinking about the principles involved in the action. You're just going on autopilot. Why should we give you moral praise for just going on autopilot? You're not even thinking about what you're doing. Then there's indirect inclination. Again, this is another form of desire. So inclination and desire, it's just sort of what you habitually like to do. So indirect inclination, here you're kind of acting like an egoist. You're thinking, well, you know, oh, I sure would like to cheat Mrs. Jones and take that 50 and stick it in my cash register and give her change and she will never be the wiser. But you think, oh, but what if somebody walks in the store right now? You're kind of paranoid about, if I ever got caught doing this, or suppose she gets back home and realizes that her $50 bill is missing and puts two and two together. Then I could end up with like the cops on my tail, if it got out that I cheated Mrs. Jones, she's beloved, the neighbors, the neighborhood, you serve this beloved figure, everybody's going to hate me, I might get pickets in front of my store, it would be really bad. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give the correct change because it's just too risky. Now, Kant, that's a pretty obvious case of like, you're not really acting morally here. You're just trying to be prudent. Because you realize that honesty is the best policy, and you don't cheat customers because you don't want to lose business or go to jail. Well, that's not really acting from a moral point of view. You're just looking out for number one. So Kant says there you don't deserve moral credit either. So just because you're a nice guy, no moral credit. Just because you're trying to keep your business going and avoid trouble, no moral credit. It's only when you act from duty and you say, oh, it would be wrong for me to cheat poor old half-blind Mrs. Jones out of her $50 bill. It's my duty to act honestly. Now, it's not like you have to sort of repeat words in your head, but you have to appreciate the fact that this is a case where you might steal, and it's wrong for you to steal, therefore you do the right thing. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be eventually, it become a habit and then you just use direct inclination and then they're waiting for that, right?
I think Kant thinks you have to be conscious of it. And he thinks that you can be conscious of whenever you're acting, think about, okay, what am I doing here? And say, oh, it's my duty to do X, Y, and Z. So it's not like you're acting on autopilot. So you're thinking duty can become sort of your automatic response. I think Kant thinks because duty comes from reason, it always involves some sort of consciousness in your mind. So to use your rational faculties requires you to sort of think about what you're doing. Whereas acting on desire doesn't, right? You think, oh, I'm thirsty, you go for a drink. And it's not like you think in your mind, I'm thirsty, you just like feel your throat's kind of parched, you see a drinking fountain, you walk over to it. It's not like you're thinking about it. It's just sort of autopilot. You have an itch, you might scratch it without even really thinking about it. But if you're in an ethical situation which requires you to make a judgment, then you have to think, okay, what should I do? Oh, I should, I've gotten the incorrect change. What do I do? And you think, oh, well, I need to make it right because that's the right thing to do. That's an interesting objection. I have to file that away. So what does it mean to act from duty? So it means acting out of respect for the moral law. So to get moral credit from action, you have to act out of respect for the moral law. Think about what is the moral law, and then say, I need to follow the rules of morality, and so in this case, here's how I do it. So you're acting from principle instead of you thinking about the consequences. And one way of saying this, in ordinary parlance, is you're doing it because it's right. So doing the right thing because it's right, as opposed to because it will get your picture in the paper, because it will give you a good reputation, because because you'll feel really guilty if you don't do it. Because it makes you feel good. So it's at doing something because it's right. And Kant thinks you can act from pure reason and from duty without desire entering in at all. So it's like and sometimes you get these cases, right, where you're thinking, well, here's what I want to do, but here's what I should do. Like, maybe it's Mother's Day, and maybe your mother's insufferable. And you think, you really don't want to call your mother, but it's Mother's Day, and so you should. And so you call your mother up and talk to her, and it's kind of painful. And afterwards, maybe you feel a sense of relief, but you didn't do it because you enjoy talking with your mother. You did it because it was your duty. And he thinks that comes from reason. It's not desire, because if you're going on desire, you wouldn't call your mother. You'd just, like, just not do it. Put it out of your mind. Yeah?
But how does he define it as it being right just because, or is it a certain norm?
So he'll have a test for what's right and wrong, but we haven't got to that yet. So just thinking about in terms of what are your motives going to be, is it because I want to, or am I going on autopilot, or am I trying to avoid trouble? So if you think, he'll fill in the blank of what actions are right and wrong and where you get these rules from. But he says there are these rules which are self-evident if you think about them. And if you act because it's the right thing to do, assuming you know what the right thing to do is, then that's what you get moral credit for, and for no other reason. Now, it's okay to have mixed motives. And this is a test question that people tend to miss. So pay attention. So Kant has pretty extremist views most of the time, but here's a case where I think he sort of makes a concession. So he says, if you're doing it because it's right, it's okay for you to enjoy doing your duty. As long as it's not your main motive. So if you're like the shopkeeper, right? So the shopkeeper gives the correct change to poor old Mrs. Jones, and then and he feels a little good about it. He's like, I did the right thing, and not every shopkeeper would do that. And by God, honesty is the best policy. And he might think as an afterthought, and hey, I'm not going to jail like Vinny down the street who was caught, you know, maybe doing something unethical. Or I have a reputation for honesty, and that's why people patronize my shop and not the shop down the corner. And it's okay for him to feel a little proud and be a little happy that he's done his duty, that he benefited someone who was, you know, it was vulnerable and he could take advantage of, but he didn't. That's okay. So it's okay. But you have to think about it as sort of icing on the cake. If your main motive for doing the right thing is because it feels good, then you don't deserve any moral credit. Can you think of what would be another case where, like, doing your duty is something you might enjoy doing? What about your duty not to kill yourself? that's a duty. I don't know if you really enjoy it, but that's a duty that people don't have a hard time with unless they're really depressed. And Kant thinks it's wrong to kill yourself, and you have a duty to preserve your own life. And so that's a case where he says it's not a struggle to do that duty. And it's okay if you don't struggle against the prohibition to commit suicide. Yeah.
What does Kant do when he runs up against a contradiction like Big Al, for example, stepping in the tube?
So the short answer, Kant says that your duties not to harm, your negative duties are greater than your duties to preserve life. And so you have an absolute duty not to kill, but that's a negative duty. But you have a positive duty to save lives, but the negative duty not to kill trumps the positive duty to save lives. So we'll get to a little more detail later on, but that's sort of the short answer. This is like the suicide case. If duty and desire coincide, you're kind of lucky. And there's the example I got ahead of myself. The duty to preserve your life is usually not a struggle, although for some people it is, but for most people, it's not a struggle. Now, Kant actually says that if you've got a terminal illness and your wife just left you and you're up to your eyeballs in debt and you really tempted to commit suicide, we'll give you a little bit more moral credit if you courageously struggle on and say, no, it would be wrong to take the easy way out, and it's wrong to kill myself. So, but you know, you don't need to be in that situation to get moral credit for not killing yourself. And it's so if you end up happy doing your duty, count yourself lucky, because it doesn't happen very often. I mean, Kant does think that if you do your duty, you're probably going to end up, you know, happier than otherwise. But there's no guarantee. And it's not like happiness is the goal. Happiness might be the byproduct, you know, in ordinary situations. But it's not what you're aiming at. Having good desires is not itself praiseworthy. So just because you sort of like helping people doesn't mean you're a good guy. So think about a philanthropist. A philanthropist is someone who helps people with money. So he gives money to the poor or to charity, you know, whatever charity it might be. So so think about a person who's driven by his compassion for his fellow human beings and gives generously to charity. Kant says, if he's doing it because he's a compassionate guy, just because he loves people, he doesn't get any moral credit. He needs to think, oh, it's my duty to help my fellow man. That has to be his main motive. If he says, oh, I just love helping people, that's not a moral duty. That's just, he's doing what he wants. And I think in Kant's way of thinking, desire is not really a foundation you can build morality on. So if he loved killing prostitutes and chopping them into bits and throwing them in the river, you'd be doing that, right? So it's, and you can't control your desires. Your desires are what they are. You're born with a certain disposition. You're given a certain upbringing. You have the desires that you have. But Kant says you do have a decision about what you do. And you can if you have desires to do bad things, you can assert your will against them and say, no, that would be wrong. And you beat down those desires and say, but get back there, you know, into your little closet, right? And then you do your duty and repress your desires. And that's, you know, Kant is from a kind of, he was a part of this pietistic movement, so he's a religious guy, and he's thinking in terms of, you have all these base desires that are sort of hiding there, and you want to beat those down and whip them into shape and keep them from making you do bad and wrong things and act according to objective moral principles based on your duty. And this is kind of it's sort of the part of the, I think you might, if you're sort of trying to psychoanalyze Kant or be like an anthropologist, you can see the sort of Germanic influence. I think Kant is in Prussia or something, so he's got this sort of kind of stoical, duty-oriented ethic. And maybe there's some influence from the culture. But, I mean, people have this, you know, in America, too, this sort of duty orientation. Did you have a question? Or just, Christmas come out, and this good old Mr. Fezziwig, where he's like the anti-Scrooge. He's what Scrooge should be in the book A Christmas Carol. I highly recommend it if you've never read A Christmas Carol or seen the movies. It's a great story, feel-good Christmas story. And there was a great Patrick Stewart, the guy that played Captain Picard in Star Trek, used to do this one-man show that was something to see. You can still do it on audio. But it's a great story. And so Mr. Fezziwig is this boss who's like the best boss ever, right? And he throws these big lavish parties for his employees on Christmas and has a big, you know, Christmas ham and dancing and festivities, and everybody loves him, right? And he's a sort of jolly old guy. But Kant would say, if he's not saying, it's my duty to be benevolent towards my employees or to provide for them in some way, if he's just like, oh, I love to throw a big party, then again, he's acting out of his desire, out of his kindly disposition. He's not really acting in a moral capacity. And this goes back, I think, to this idea that Kant has, that he's a psychological egoist when it comes to desire. But then you think, well, why isn't he pigeonholed into being an ethical egoist then? Well, because he thinks you can act from motives other than desire. You can act from reason. And reason has nothing to do with, acting from reason has nothing to do with your desires. Objections to Kant. So one thing you might say is, coming back to Scrooge, that compare like Mother Teresa with Scrooge. Now, Kant would say that if Mother Teresa wasn't acting from duty, and she said that, you know, she helped the poor of Calcutta and did sort of devote her life to them because she had love and compassion for them. And if that was her only motive, then Kant would say that she's no better than Scrooge, who's all about counting money and being selfish and this seems kind of weird. And what Kant would say, well, both these people are following their desires. Mother Teresa wants to help people. That's sort of what floats her boat, right? So that's what she does. Scrooge likes counting money in his cold, dark, counting house. And that's what makes him happy. You can't look at the... Kant would say, don't look at the consequences that Scrooge is hoarding money, which could be used to help the poor. And Mother Teresa is poor herself, but she's helping people individually in India. He would say you can't look at the consequences and how much they benefit people. Look at what their motive is. And Mother Teresa, it's like she's just doing what she wants to do. What she wants to do happens to be helping people. What Scrooge wants to do happens to be just making money. I think my PowerPoint's repeating what I just said here. So both Mother Teresa and Scrooge are motivated by desire. Only consequences are different, right? For Scrooge, the consequences is these guys come to him to collect some money. They're taking up a collection for the poor. This Scrooge, it's customary at this time of year of Christmas celebration to give a little something to the poor and needy. And Scrooge says, "Bah, humbug," whatever. And they say, "What shall we put you down for?" And Scrooge says, "Nothing." "Oh, you wish to remain anonymous." He says, "I wish to be left alone," and chases them out, right? And so it's like that. So the consequences for the poor are really bad because they're not getting the help they need. And for Mother Teresa, the consequences are some really poor, sick person is getting care, and even if they end up not making it, they have somebody to wipe their fevered brow in their last moments of life and someone to give them a little compassion and kindness. And maybe they recover because of her nurturing care. But it's like, what's the motive? They're just doing what they want to do. It's just the consequences are different. Morality doesn't depend on the consequences, according to Kant. And so that's what might be leading you astray. Morality is independent of consequences. Oh, and I mentioned this earlier. Again, people can't control what they desire. I have a friend who, she's like really stuck on this guy who's got all sorts of all kinds of problems. He's got a temper. He's got sort of psychological problems, issues with intimacy, a bunch of health problems. Can get kind of mean, right? All these problems, but she's like, "But I love him. I can't help it. Every time I think about him, I just want to be with him." And it's like, you have who knows why, you have all these subconscious things bubbling down there beneath the surface that cause you to like fixate on one particular person, and you feel what you feel. And there might be somebody else that's like an ideal match for you, share the same values, they're kind and compassionate, and they're friendly, and they're really good with kids, and you want to have kids. That's the other thing, this guy doesn't want to have kids, right? And she's really, her clock's ticking, and she really wants to have kids. But so she still wants to be with this guy. And even though it makes no rational sense, but she feels what she feels, right? So She can't control her feelings. What she can control, though, is not staying in that bad relationship. She can get the hell out and, try to get over them. You know, eventually the feelings will fade away. But those feelings aren't something you can, like, sort of turn off and on with a switch. And this is why Kant's very suspicious of desire. You can't control your desires and your feelings. You can control what you do. And that's why morality is all about what you do and doing your duty and, you know, sometimes having a fight against those desires. So you can control your rational choices. You can control what you do. And it's the same thing with, like, the case of adultery or something like that. You can't, because you see, like, a really attractive woman and you can't think in, you know, if you're like a normal heterosexual man, you look at a really attractive woman, you're like, wow, you know, and you start feeling, you know, the pull of desire, right? If you can decide, the question about whether you act on it, if you're in a committed monogamous relationship, then it's like, you have to say no. That's, you know, Kant would say that's wrong, beat down those desires, saying no, wrong, bad, right? And then not put yourself in a compromising situation too. So maybe not, you don't want to, if you're away at a convention, you don't want to be hanging out at the hotel bar around closing time when you might be tempted to go with some of the other people there around closing time who are, you know, looking for a little love on the side or what have you. So to act morally, again, you have to appreciate an act's moral qualities. You have to think about what are the moral principles involved. Kant is psychological egoist with regard to desire. And some of this is a repeat. I sort of drum some of the stuff into your head here. So Kant's an egoist only with regard to desire. So desires are all selfish. But sometimes you can act from reason and not from desire. So when you're acting from reason, you're acting morally. Moral action isn't motivated by desire, but only by reason. So when you're acting from duty, you're acting from reason. When you're acting from desire, you're acting selfishly. When you're acting from duty, you're acting unselfishly. And then, you know, morality is doing what you should do, whether you want to or not. And Kant, again, tends to think about what you should do and what you want to do as being on opposite sides and sort of having to pick between the two. Although occasionally they go together and then it's kind of lucky. So, make sure we've got this here. Morality is doing what you should do, morality is doing what you should do, whether you want to or not. Anybody still writing? I put a bunch on the slide. Morality is doing what you should do, whether you want to or not. Can I go to the next one?
Yeah, these are going to be online, right?
Yeah, these are online too. Okay, so now we're getting to the nitty-gritty of, like, Kant's view. So how do you tell what things are right and wrong? First, you have to understand what an imperative is. So an imperative is a general policy or principle of action. And Kant says there's two, and he also calls a imperative a command we give ourselves. So in English, there's the imperative form, which is like, go away, I'm busy, or get out of here, or do your homework, or whatever. Recycle, right? It's because you're telling people to do something. It's a command. And so the imperative form in English is when you tell someone to do something. It's you, usually there's an implied you. You do this, you do that. Let me think of some other imperative that you hear. Pay your taxes. All right, so or, you know, don't forget to vote. So an imperative is a kind of a command that we give ourselves. It's our policy for action. So Kant thinks for every act you perform, there's some principle that represents, whether you're conscious of it or not. And there's two kinds of imperatives. One is, he calls a hypothetical imperative. A hypothetical imperative tells you how to achieve some desire. So given that you want a certain thing, here's what you do to get it. Okay. So a hypothetical desire tells you how to achieve some desire. Then he says there's another kind called a categorical imperative. Categorical imperatives tell you what you have to do regardless of your desires or regardless of what you want. So I've got a couple of particular examples. So hypothetical tells you how to achieve some desire you already have. Categorical says, you know, sometimes people say categorically, I'm telling you categorically, what's an example? Categorically, all college professors are communists or whatever. Or categorically, Berkeley Street vendors are crazy or something. So people will say, they'll say things are categorically means across the board, no matter what. Those are both false statements. I think it's something that's a good case where someone used the phrase categorically.
Categorically deny these charges.
Oh, excellent. Thank you very much. I categorically deny these charges, right? You hear that? That means there's no evidence for them whatsoever. I didn't sexually harass these women when I was at, you know, this certain at the restaurant association. I categorically deny it. It's good to have a sexual harassment, a fresh sexual harassment example without having to go back to Clinton. Sometimes I hate using the dated examples. Bill is trying to decide whether he should buy that new LP, that new 78 LP, or some more Brill cream. You know, what should he do? Okay, hypothetical imperatives. So these are practical guidelines, totally unrelated to morality. So, and they always take a certain form. If you want X, do Y. So this is the kind of means-ends reasoning that you see in utilitarianism. Okay, you have a certain goal, and here's what you do to get it. In utilitarianism, there's a goal to create happiness, and then so you figure out what the best way to do it is. So you're in hypothetical imperatives, you're thinking about the consequences. And you're thinking about the consequences for you. So you're thinking, okay, I want, I think I got some examples here. If you want to lose weight, eat fewer calories and exercise more. Easier said than done, he says from personal experience. But, you know, if you, regardless of your metabolism, if you eat fewer calories, you know, it's a lap band, or whether it's, you know, the virtual lap band, or a lock in the refrigerator, or whatever, or eat more vegetables, and if you exercise more, do that cardio, you're going to lose weight. Now, what if you're like, some sort of twig person, right? Where you're like, you're already underweight. Maybe you're anorexic. It doesn't apply to you. Maybe you just have a normal, healthy body weight. Then that doesn't apply to you. So it only applies with you if you have a desire to lose weight. If you want a safe and yet profitable investment, select a diversified mutual fund. Not so good advice anymore, I think, but suppose you're a starving college student, right? I should update this example. I should put buy gold or something in there. Buy precious metals and invest in the developing economies. But the idea is that if you don't have any money to invest, then investment advice doesn't apply to you. This hypothetical imperative doesn't apply to you. It's irrelevant to you. Because you don't have the desire, because you don't have the means. You don't even have the ability. If you want to improve your grades, spend more time studying, right? But what if you're already getting straight A's, right? Do you need to spend more time studying? It doesn't apply. You're not thinking about how can I get better grades if your grades are already straight A's. So again, they only apply to you if you have the requisite desire. The categorical imperatives have to do with morality. These are the absolute guidelines which comprise morality. So if you have a question, if there's a question on the test that asks you, well, what makes up morality? Hypothetical imperatives, categorical imperatives, hypothetical imperatives and categorical imperatives. Neither hypothetical imperatives nor categorical imperatives. You want to say only the categorical imperatives. These are the ones that make up morality. So morality is made up of these categorical imperatives that say, no matter what, don't do this. Or, no matter what, do this. So you have both negative prohibitions and requirements. Don't kill innocent people. But I really like killing innocent people. It's fun. No, you can't do it. So it doesn't matter what you desire. If you just strongly desire killing innocent people, it's still wrong. You still can't do it. Don't cheat on your ethics test. Right? But I'm failing the course. No, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter how strongly you desire to get a grade you don't deserve. You still can't do it. So here's a positive one. Help people in need. But I want to keep my money all for myself. I want to buy more frivolous luxuries. Or, you know, I'm kind of living hand to mouth here. I don't have much to give. Well, everybody can give something, I think Kant would say. So you have a duty to help those in need, even if you don't want to. It's still incumbent on you to do so as a moral agent. Keep your promises. Oh, but this promise is really inconvenient. Right, so Bill Burroughs has his econ class where you get to write down your score for the quizzes, and I got like a 7 on this quiz because I was going out of town. I didn't do the homework. I just sort of guessed on the homework questions, and I got a 7. And he said, you know, it's on the honor system, and so the paper's going around. The person that marked my paper's long gone. I'm like one of the last ones there. I could have put a 10 if I wanted to. I gotten 10s on all the other quizzes. But I was an honest person. I put the 7 there. Why? Because, you know, this sort of implies, that might be a case of cheating. Don't cheat on your econ score. But, you know, it's maybe there's an implied promise there, too, that to be honest. He actually put some sort of contract that has, like, a promise there in the class. Let's see, what do we got here? I think, let's save the categorical imperative for next time. So that's it for today. We'll continue with Kant on Wednesday. I'll get the forum topics up right after class here, as well as the PowerPoint and the recording. And I'll see you guys on Wednesday. Don't forget about the debate on the cost of education, what we can do about it. Tuesday, 11:30, cafeteria.